Good morning. It's Thursday, February 13th. From HPR2, it's The Conversation. Up today, growing Hawaii entrepreneurs and communities. Sounds good, right? About the small business part, one young entrepreneur says most definitely, as far as growing a community. If the one in question is Ko'olauloa, we'll hear from a resident who says absolutely not. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich.
Well, there's not much controversy over why it's important to get kids to eat well. I'm Chris Vandercook. And today we'll talk with a longtime Big Island educator about a new program to teach healthy food and growing habits. And this half hour, a look at the long-standing tradition of Beijing opera in Honolulu.
Now the news.
Good morning and welcome to The Conversation. I'm Chris Vandercook. Good morning, Beth Ann.
Good morning.
Small business in Hawaii sometimes feels beleaguered, but they're going to have their day, huh?
Well, many of them are already having their day. They've been quietly doing that. But how we look at small business versus entrepreneurship is rather the subject of our first conversation this morning. Now, just think for a second. How many times do you hear the word entrepreneur these days? Often it may be in connection with startup programs, incubators, and conversations about diversifying and growing Hawaii's economy. All to the good for many small businesses who want to show lawmakers just what role they play. They'll be at the state capitol on March 5th for the High Growth Entrepreneurs Day. Dave Kozuki will be there representing his company, Toe Choice, and he'll be reminding lawmakers of the face of Hawaii's new entrepreneur. He's on the phone with us right now. Good morning.
Good morning.
We used to use that phrase, small business owner, and now we often just use the catch-all entrepreneur to describe someone who starts a small business. Is there a difference?
Well, you know, I grew up probably in the third generation of entrepreneurs and small business owners. My family has been doing brick-and-mortar type businesses, of course, ever since I could remember. And to me, that's what that always has been. It's just that now we're in a different era where Hawaii businesses or places, if you're in a place that's remote, you can have a national and global audience from wherever you are.
That's sort of, you know, the mechanism of all of that. But just, you grew up in a small business family, as you just mentioned, and you saw this as you were looking to do something with your own life. You've been involved with other companies. This is not your first venture, but certainly it's one that's proving to be rather profitable. How would you describe some of the tenets of entrepreneurship that you think we need to pay more attention to?
Well, you know, with entrepreneurship, there's a lot of risk-taking. And I think compared to other places in Hawaii, there's a that's not part of the culture, really, where it hasn't been in the past. I think you mentioned some of the programs going on today locally. And I think that culture of risk-taking and reaching out is being taught and is being seen by those younger students and entrepreneurs coming up, and they're starting to learn that. That's definitely something we in Hawaii need to learn to act on a lot faster.
That element of risk-taking is not necessarily something that might be embodied then by a small business owner. Is that the difference then?
Well, I think once you are a small business owner, I think you've kind of passed that that mentality. You know, if you're doing it, you've decided, I'm going to take the jump, I'm going to take the leap, I'm going to do this on my own. It's versus going to work for a larger company or someone else that is the choice, right? So once you've made that choice, you're kind of on that path, I think.
That's true. But, for example, I could go out and buy a business tomorrow and inherit goodwill, inherit customer base, inherit all kinds of things associated with that business. But I'm not quite sure that would make me an entrepreneur in the same way that you are an entrepreneur. Would it?
Okay, you mean like, well, I think that would qualify someone as an entrepreneur, as long as they're in the business. But it is different, you're correct, from starting from scratch coming up with the idea, developing the plan, building the team, finding the funding, building the product, all those things. Yeah, that, there's a lot that goes into that. And that is, yeah, I guess there is a difference there. Just buying into it versus building it.
Because it used to be that when we would use the term entrepreneur, all the things that you just mentioned were embodied in that. Somebody who had a vision and usually a pretty grand one, and then was able to put all these other pieces into the puzzle, and suddenly there was this vision, maybe lesser or greater than had been originally conceived, but there was someone who was, you know, driving the boat in a for everybody. And we tend to use that term now, entrepreneur, to mean just sort of anyone who has a business and who is doing some of the same things. But I'm just wondering if somehow we've diluted a very rarefied group. Do you think so?
Well, I think there's the barriers to entry, especially in the tech side today, are lowered. They're much lowered. If you think about all the infrastructure, if you just think about restaurants as a kind of an old school type concept. If you were to start a restaurant from scratch, you'd have a shell of a place, and you'd have to go and do your plumbing and your vent and your heating and your conditioning and all the cooking plate utensils and the tables and chairs. There'd be a lot to do. To start a business even in the tech community, that's what you have to do before. You have to get all your servers, your programmers, blah, 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 right? Nowadays, a lot of that infrastructure is readily available. So it's sort of like getting a space, a restaurant space, already picked out and built. Now for a tech company, a lot of that technical infrastructure, the connectivity, the servers, is available very easily instead of building up yourself. So it's easier to get into entrepreneurial tech business today. So the barrier to entry is lower, which gives everyone a better chance to get started. But then the next steps get harder and harder because you're competing with a lot of different people.
There also seems to be, though, a different way of looking at how business is being done now, particularly among young entrepreneurs, in the way they view collaboration and success. Would that be true?
Well, I mean, in general, we're all much more connected now, right, because of the internet and social media and whatnot. So I think we've grown up, the young entrepreneurs today have grown up in a world where everyone is connected, and hopefully you can see the benefits of that, whether it's collaborating with someone in your local area or someone across the country or someone globally. That opportunity is there, and we certainly do that in our company. And there's the benefits of finding the best resources, the best people all over the place when you have that collaboration.
Is there any downside to that?
I'm not sure about downsides. It's a matter of ideas spread so fast. You walk this fine line of sharing what you have and collaborating versus, well, someone's going to take my idea. And you need to kind of lean more towards being a little more open and moving fast versus being secret about everything and hoping someone's not going to copy your idea, because it's going to happen anyway.
And that's just a fact that you accept.
Yeah, I mean, you gotta, like I said, you're walking the fine line. You just gotta kind of play it smart, figure out who your partners are, who you're working with, and decide how much information you're giving out. But the key again overall is to move fast. And if you keep everything secret, it's hard to do that.
Okay, so I hear you say move fast, be discerning as you're moving fast, and don't be afraid to collaborate.
Right.
If you had to sort of paint me a picture of what Hawaii entrepreneurism looks like now, I mean, particularly for your cohort, what would you say?
Okay, so when you talk about cohort, I think you're referring to the fact that we went through the first cohort of Blue Startups.
No, I wasn't thinking just about Blue Startups, but I mean just in general of, you know, those of you who are doing what you're doing now, creating businesses and who are young entrepreneurs. Is there something about that group that everybody else isn't seeing? Something you'd like us to know about that group in particular, what you guys look like, what is really, really different about you that you think maybe we aren't noticing as much?
Well, maybe if you see different from previous generations, you know, Sequoia has always had a lot of smart people. And some of them stay, but a lot of them leave. And pretty much the path to get anywhere in the past was to go ahead and leave. But we've had a lot of people leave and come back. And so now that the younger folks today that are entrepreneurial have resource to look to and tap into that experience that we didn't have before. Combine that with the opportunity to get into technology businesses a lot easier and have resources all over the world. That capability is allowing some of the folks to try it out here versus automatically leaving. And so in that fact, there's a lot going on in the ecosystem now that supports these young entrepreneurs to go ahead and take a stab at it.
And to be able to stay here while they're doing it. Well, we wish you all of the best with Toe Choice. Seems like you're doing a really great job and enjoying it too. Thanks so much for spending a little time with us this morning.
Thank you.
We've been just talking with Dave Kozuki, who's the co-founder and CEO of Toe Choice. It's an instant mobile bidding platform to provide roadside assistance to a stranded motorist. It's headquartered in Honolulu, but it also operates on the mainland and was part of the Blue Startups cohort. You're listening to The Conversation on Statewide, member-supported HBR2 at 8:16. Coming up, the long tradition of Beijing opera at UH. But get ready, here comes the quiz.
The sport of windsurfing may not have originated in our islands, but it's more like its traditional cousin, for which Hawaii is present. Famous. From the origins in the 1960s, windsurfing in Maui's Ho'okipa Beach has become a world-renowned location for windsurfers to show off their skills. Not only is Hawaii home to one of the most optimal locales for windsurfing, it's also one of the sport's most well-known athletes grew up. To be specific, the man in question grew up in Kailua on Oahu's east side. He's the subject of today's quiz. Here are a couple of hints about him to get you headed in the right direction. He won his first overall windsurfing world championship title at the age of 13 and manufactures an extensive line of sailboards, sails, and kitesurfing equipment bearing his last name. So, can you name him? Post your answer to Facebook at Hawaii Conversation or wait for the answer to blow your way later in the show.
Good morning, I'm Karen Meyer from Manoa Valley Theater. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR2, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
Moving on now to a unique cultural opportunity for Hawaii, one that's been with us for half a century now. The production at UH Manoa of English language versions of Jingchu or Beijing opera. It's a heavily ritualized form of theatrical performance that draws upon such skills as mime, acrobatics, and vocal music to tell classic stories of ancient China. One such story is Lady Mu and the Yang Family Generals, and its principal actor, Sammy Acuna, is with us this morning. Good morning, Sammy.
Good morning.
Thanks for coming in.
My pleasure.
You grew up on Hawaii Island, and you're of part Chinese heritage, but it's still kind of a journey for you to be a Chinese opera performer, yeah?
Absolutely.
Well, how did it happen?
Well, I had returned to school after performing professional with a dance company here in Honolulu, and that semester in 2010, they just happened to be mounting the production of Baisujin, which was The White Snake, mm-hmm. which was directed by Dr. Elizabeth Wickman-Walzak. And after graduating last semester, 4 years have come around again, and they are producing, of course, every 4 years, a Jingju production. And I am still performing in the show, which is the Lady Mu and the Yang Family Generals.
So you came from the place of dance rather than acting.
Yes, I have a dance background. I used to dance with Iona Pear Dance mm-hmm. Company, which mm-hmm. is now the new Iona Contemporary Dance Company. Mm-hmm. And so that's where my foundation stems
But from. as a form of theater, it's one where dance training is extremely important, yeah?
Absolutely. The physicality involved in Jingju or Beijing opera is very much a part of it. It's one of the four techniques that is involved in Jingju theater. There's speech, song, dance acting, as Wei La Shi or Dr. Elizabeth Wickman Walzak likes to call it, and martial and combat.
Dance acting, did you say?
Yes, so dance acting involves pantomime, movement qualities, roundness, as we are taught.
Roundness?
Roundness. There's a lot of round movements in the physicality and also in the presentation of our speech and song.
Sort of using your body to kind of imply circular shapes, not angular, but...
Yes, it's supposed to be round, makes everything look beautiful on
yeah.
stage. Yes.
Yeah. Well, it's been quite a journey for you, but in a way it's a rediscovery of your own personal heritage, yeah?
Absolutely, yes. My grandfather, or my great-grandfather's name was Apu, which is a Chinese name, and I was... also named Apu, which is my middle name. And during the learning process, when the teachers come over from China, all the students are given a Chinese name. And what they do is they usually translate their English names or whichever names they have. And for my name, which was Apu, they took that name and they translated it into the way they would pronounce it in the region that they come from. So Apu is translated into Abiao, which is my Chinese name that they address me as.
Does this, where does this take you in your future as a performer?
As a Jingju performer, I think it's a skill that's only afforded to students that come to the University of Hawaii because it's something you can't get anywhere else unless you are training in China. And even to be a part of that school. Dr. Elizabeth was the first non-Chinese performer to participate in the technique of Jingju or Beijing opera.
Mm-hmm.
So when she came back to Hawaii, she was able to afford that luxury to us. So I think it's such a great opportunity, and it's one of the reasons a lot of students come to the University of Hawaii Theater and Dance Program. It's particularly because of the Asian theaters program.
Yeah, I would imagine, because you're certainly not going to find anything like it anywhere else.
No, yes.
How does the English translation work? I mean, how effective is it to take something as different as this is and move it into English?
Well, the teachers do not speak any English,
uh-huh.
So we have translators. And what happens is, to get the essence of the song and the speech, we have to learn everything in Chinese.
Mm-hmm.
So we will learn all the songs in Chinese, and then we will learn all the speech in Chinese. And we try to translate that into English by still maintaining the essence of the flavor of the Chinese.
Yeah, that's tricky, though, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, it's very tricky, because if you take a Chinese script, which might have so many vowels and consonants, mm-hmm. and then try to match that up with English, sometimes they don't match up.
No, I would think they frequently wouldn't match up,
yes.
Because, you know, everything I hear about Chinese language is that it's very, very nuanced, that a character can mean a dozen different things.
Yes,
yeah.
And we learn about the four tones in Chinese language, and we try to translate that into the speech and in song in Jingju.
What are those four tones?
Well, I will try to...
Please, I'm curious.
There's yes, 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 yes. I think those are the four.
I heard a little variation.
Yeah, so there is a bit of variation about like how it goes up, or where one is a question, like yes, or one is like an answer to a question. And we have to try to learn these four tones, which is prevalent in Chinese language. And then we use that in the English translation.
Well, because that would make a big difference in just the meaning in how you delivered a line.
Absolutely.
And what it actually conveyed.
Yes.
Yeah? And that's married to the motion through a lot of mime, you said.
Yes, the physical or the dance acting, as Dr. Elizabeth Wickman Walzak always affirms in our teaching, is that the dance acting, there's a lot, sometimes you come into this technique as like a performer, as myself, in dance, it's hard to kind of let go of that technique.
Yeah.
And try to adopt this new style. And so there's always a lot of pushing and nudging and trying to learn this new technique and try to not abolish what I've already have learned from my own personal background. But
well, it's clear that you continue learning through this.
Yes, so everything is quite a challenge.
I imagine.
It's great, yes.
Well, I wish you luck and continue to challenge yourself.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Sammy Acuna plays the title character in Lady Mu and the Yang Family Generals. It opens February 20th, runs until March 1st at Kennedy Theater on the Manoa campus. And you can find out more at hpr2.org.
Hundreds of thousands are in the dark after another winter storm barrels through the South.
You may be without power for a couple of days. You need to have your food and water stocked. We're going to open shelters. We've got the National Guard on standby.
Sticking it out through the latest round of nasty winter weather in a region unaccustomed to the cold. That's next time on The Takeaway from PRI, Public Radio International.
This morning at 9, right after the conversation.
Hawaii Public Radio salutes its dedicated station members. The station's business model is an unlikely one, and your personal commitment is proof positive that it's one that can work. We gratefully acknowledge Remedios Hartman of Honolulu, Ben Wayne of Santa Monica, California, and Benedict Twigg-Smith of Honolulu for your recent gifts. We're proud to count you among HPR's growing family of members. Now join the people who are making a difference every day. Follow the support link at hpr2.org.
Support for today's programming comes from the Public Administration Program at UH Manoa, Education for Public Service. Now accepting applications for the master's degree and graduate certificate. Learn more at puba.hawaii.edu.
Now, maybe you don't routinely check the salaries of other states' education superintendents, but the Board of Education, some advocacy groups, and lawmakers have been doing just that. Parity with other states is the issue. In this session, lawmakers are considering whether that means they should raise the cap on the superintendent's annual salary from $150,000 to $250,000. Chad Blair from Civil Beat has today's details in the Reality Check. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
So, I mean, people hear that $100,000 cap ceiling moving ever higher and gulp. But the point of it is that's just a ceiling. That's not saying that her salary overnight would move to that. But the real issue is, are we paying our superintendent of education enough when compared to other states?
Right, and boy, wouldn't that be nice, a $100,000 raise. But when you do look at the 15 largest school districts, Hawaii superintendent is way at the bottom with that $150,000 salary. Many of the superintendents in like New York, Los Angeles, Chicago, Miami-Dade, they're making $250,000, well into $350,000. Hawaii's district, school district, it's the largest employer in the state. The concern is that if you want to attract top-notch candidates, you got to pay them competitive salaries.
A couple of things. Yes, largest employer, what, about 180,000 people employed?
Something like that. Yeah, it's the ninth largest K-12 student population as well.
Yeah, so managing a lot of people and responsible for quite a bit. But then again, some of those other states that you mentioned a moment ago, they're doing much better than Hawaii.
Well, certainly there are standards to be looked at, and under Catherine Montiyoshi's tenure, there have been a couple of noticeable things. I mean, they finally settled the teacher's contract, although that's not necessarily under her purview. There is the improvement in Race to the Top. The Board of Education has actually given her an exceptional rating for her performance. Montiyoshi declined to talk to us, but her contract is up in June, and one must be thinking that the board is deciding whether to retain her or to seek another candidate.
Well, she's done well. She's obviously gotten good reviews from what you've just talked about. But sort of the underlying principle of all of this stuff is should this be tied to merit as opposed to just saying we need to be, you know, commensurate with everybody else's salaries? Do we really say that money has to have a component of merit in it? And is this, you know, the bills are moving through the ledge now that seem to be all about the money. Is that causing some frustration?
Well, Gene Ward, the Republican from Hawaii Kai, did say that. Is it all about the money, or should we have some performance-based measurements? But the bill is moving along, and thus far the support has been pretty strong for a pay raise for the superintendent.
Because the bottom line is that whether she's retained or whether they find someone else, they're trying to attract quality talent.
That's correct.
All right. We'll wait and see what happens. Thanks, Chad.
Thanks, Beth Ann.
Talk to you tomorrow. Chad Blair is the political reporter for CivilBeat.com.
Tonight at 5, Beth Ann, you'll be bringing us Town Square, and there's an ongoing discussion about raising the minimum wage in Hawaii.
Discussion and bills moving from the ledge and a national conversation.
Yeah, a lot of movement in that direction, and some revised sort of approaches to the discussion, yeah.
Well, that's something that we started to talk about a little earlier this week when Carl Bonham was here. And we got some response to that, and we'd already, you know, planned to have a town square about this. So now's your chance if you really want to talk about the minimum wage. We're going to have Carl Bonham back from UHERO. He's going to be here to look at some of the more recent research, some of which are just still in draft form, some of what he's been reading through and seeing that says that maybe the argument that a higher minimum wage results in job loss isn't necessarily so true, and that there are nuances and that there are subtleties that you know, very staid argument is missing.
Yeah, that was interesting when he said that, because that's been a sort of a widely held assumption for a long time, that it would have an inevitable impact, make it tougher, especially for small businesses to operate.
Well, and that's why we're going to have Sherry Manor McNamara here from the Chamber of Commerce to let us know what she's hearing from her constituency. Also, Appleseed staff attorney Jenny Lee will be here to take a look at why, you know, she says this argument may or may not hold a whole lot of water in looking at what people really need to have in their hands, more cash to be able to have a little bit better standard of living.
But it's difficult to think of people who are not affected by this. No matter where you are on the economic stratum, this is going to affect you.
In some way or other. The question is how, and how businesses will cope if, in fact, we do vote to, or if the legislature will increase the minimum wage. We'll see what happens on that front. But as far as having the right information on which to make that decision, that's what we're going to talk about
tonight.
That's our job. Some of the newer stuff that Carl Bonham is bringing to us tonight. We hope you'll plan to join us at 5 o'clock for Town Square.
All right. Thanks, Beth Ann.
the review of the Ko'olauloa Sustainable Communities Plan has spawned one controversy after another. That's the plan to rezone agricultural lands in La'ie, Kahuku, Haula, and Ko'olauloa. It would expand Brigham Young University, the Polynesian Cultural Center, and add hundreds of homes and assorted suburban necessities. The latest draft is now with the city's Zoning and Planning Committee, and it continues to cause a deep divide among the area's residents. Now, some of them will be marching through parts of their community on Sunday to show their displeasure. Joshua Nonga is a Haula resident opposed to the development of the rural character of his home, and he joins us now by phone. Good morning.
Aloha, Beth Ann. Mahalo for having me.
Glad to talk to you. Now, you've been dealing with this for a very long time. I mean, this plan has been looked at and very, very slowly moving along because it seems to just meet controversy at every turn, and in part, some controversy driven by you and those who believe, as you do, that the plan does not really meet the needs of the community, in fact, might threaten its future. Why do you say that?
Well, first off, the plan does not only meet the needs of the community, it threatens our rural country character, as well as violates the traditional and customary rights of Native Hawaiians and the rights of Kuleana landholders.
Specifically what? How does it do that as you read it? Just the fact that it's there and developing anything or in the way it's developed?
No, currently there are Kuleana landholders, that Native Hawaiians who live on the land right now, who have held title to that land since 1850. Now, the Mormon Church, through their continuous practices of adverse possession, which has displaced and dispossessed many of their own Native Hawaiian church members, taking away their land for the idea of expansion. Now, at this moment in time, the 2012 Ko'olauloa Sustainable Communities Plan would call for the building of a new Malaikahana town, as well as a building of a new Mauka connector road that will connect the towns of Kahuku, this new Malaikahana town, La'ie, and this road will cut right across Kuleana landholders, violating the traditional and customary rights of Native Hawaiians.
You mentioned a moment ago that the Mormon Church has taken lands that belong to Native Hawaiians. How do you substantiate that?
Beth Ann, have you heard the term adverse possession?
What do you mean when you say adverse possession?
Adverse possession is a legal term which states that a person may come onto a property as a trespasser and over time in hostile opening, in notorious hostile opening, by essentially squatting on this land for long enough time. Here in Hawaii, it's 20 years. They will be able to then take claim to the land and take title to the land.
Right, claim by possession.
Right, adverse possession. Much of what many of the big five sugar planters have done to many Kuleana landholders in the past.
And that's what you believe the Mormon Church has done?
That is not what I believe. That is what it's fact. That is what currently they are doing. That is what they have done and currently aim to do at this moment.
But it doesn't look like they're going to pull up stakes and go anyplace soon, Joshua. Is there any way of being able to create some sort of detente with the Mormon Church? Because this has been going on for a long, long time.
We as a community have come up with a compromise in the 2009 Planning Action Committee that worked for 2 years along with is a 27-member planning committee, which then proposed and gave all of these compromises for affordable housing to be built within the existing footprint of La'ie. We would allow for the the height restrictions to be lifted and allow for this growth to happen, but stay within the existing footprint of La'ie.
And that was the real sticking point.
That was the real sticking point. That's right. And because they state because of economic viability, which is, you know, is better known as profit or bottom line, they aren't able to do that. Or that's their position.
So now the plan that's being looked at is very different from what you would like it to be, and it's so dividing the community. How do you survive when you talk to other community members who think that maybe the plan might be okay?
Well, what we've done is that we're going to show that the majority of Ko'olauloa and our community members are opposed to this development, whether they be Hawaiian or non-Hawaiian, that currently HRI, PCC, BYU Hawaii, in collaboration with the city government, Mayor Caldwell's administration, is essentially telling a lie that we need this town for affordable housing, since in reality we don't. Now, to answer your question about how we meet these people, we show them the true plan. They will change their minds when the truth is revealed. And right now the truth is being so muddled because of big money, okay, and our government is allowing to put these companies to put profit before people. That's one of the essential flaws of this plan and essentially what's happening right now in our community.
The idea of profits before people has been one that's been used. There was a rally to that effect. It's been used throughout various different points of contention in our communities, but specifically for yours, because there has been so much controversy and so much rancor over time, you know, not even being able to move it along very, you know, even not forget briskly, but just at a reasonable pace because there is so much controversy and that's not stopping. So going out and marching on Sunday and still talking to people one by one by one while the Zoning Commission or committee is going to be looking at this plan, do you think you've got really a decent chance of being able to change anyone's mind on the committee?
I believe we have a phenomenal chance. And if Ikaika Anderson, Councilwoman Kimberly Pine, Councilwoman Ann Kobayashi, as well as Councilman Breen Hamimoto, they understand and they see the truth of the reality that the majority of the people of Kolaloa do not want this plan, do not believe it's sustainable for our future, that it threatens our Hawaiian community, our rural Hawaiian community, and they understand that it goes against the general plan, which aimed to preserve Kolaloa as a rural country setting. They understand that, and they will see, and I believe we have more than a decent chance, Beth Ann. We have a phenomenal chance of changing their mind, and that happens this Sunday when everyone comes out to Malaikahana to come and stand with us, to show their support that we oppose the urbanization of Kolaloa, the violation of traditional customary rights of Native Hawaiians, as well as this need, this lie, to build new developments, reckless developments, and saying that these jobs are going to help our people when essentially they won't provide a livable wage for us to continue to live on our own island.
Well, Joshua, we wish you all the best and hope everything goes well and safely on Sunday.
Thank you, Beth Ann. Mahalo for having me here. Mahalo, everybody. God bless. Aloha.
Aloha. Joshua Nongai was raised in Haula, where he still lives, and he's a member of the Ko'olauloa Hawaiian Civic Club. He, as you heard, strongly opposes the proposed large-scale development of Malaikahana, and he and many of his friends and residents will be walking, residents of the area in which he lives, will be walking in Sunday's Aloha Aina March for Ko'olauloa.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Central Pacific Bank, offering the exceptional checking account, which includes an identity theft protection package that alerts users if personal information is compromised. Learn more at centralpacificbank.com.
And in case you were waiting for the answer to today's backyard quiz, well, wait no longer. This morning we focused our attention on the sport of windsurfing. Though this particular outdoor activity didn't have its origins in Hawaii, it has become very popular here since the 1960s. Maui's Ho'okipa Beach offers optimal wind and wave conditions. There are other places. And along with having some of the best spots, Hawaii is also where one of the sport's most famous athletes grew up. To be specific, Kailua on Oahu's east side was his home. And for today's quiz, we asked you his name. For hints, we told you that he won his first overall world championship title at age 13, and he now owns and manufactures his own line of sailboards and windsurfing equipment. And we understand that Robbie Nash isn't half bad on the big waves either. It's now 8:48, and that's today's quiz. If you've got one, send it in to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Aloha, I'm Lisa Nakamichi from the Aloha International Piano Festival. You're tuned to HPR2, Hawaii Public Radio. Learn more about what you hear on the show at facebook.com/HIConversation.
If your memory of school lunches includes menu items such as cream chip beef, mac and cheese, and mystery meat, you might be surprised at what's turning up in the cafeteria these days. On Hawaii Island, 63 school and community gardens are now part of the Hawaii Island School Garden Network. It's changing the way a lot of people think about food, with an emphasis on fresh and locally grown. Nancy Redfeather of the Kohala Center runs the program, and she's with us by phone. Good morning, Nancy.
Good morning, Chris. Thanks so much for calling.
Sure. You know, those of us who remember school lunch back in the day, I wonder how I lived this long based on what we were fed back in school. It wasn't about balanced nutrition at all. Didn't seem that way anyway.
Well, maybe it's because I'm so old, but when I went to school, school lunches were still being made in cafeterias by staff from scratch.
Mm-hmm.
But that's been a long time.
You went to better schools than I did, it sounds like. But, you know, there was it was pretty starchy and not a lot of fresh vegetables, certainly not in my memories anyway.
Right, and there's a new emphasis, and it's really coming from the USDA and the school lunch program across the United States to increase the amount of fresh fruits and vegetables that are included in the children's plate each day, because we know that these fresh fruits and vegetables will help the children be healthier.
Sure. When you get a school garden started, what are your first steps? What are the first things you grow, and how do you teach that?
Well, a lot of times the school will develop a school garden committee that's made up of teachers and administrators, maybe some community, parents, interested, even some students, and they pretty much do some strategic planning and decide how they want to use the garden, where they want to place the garden, what they might be growing, how it would be used, who would take care of it, and those kinds of things. So there's a lot of pre-planning that goes into developing a school garden that's connected with the school curriculum.
What are the best things to grow to get it started?
Well, it really depends on where you are, because some of our schools are right on the ocean front, like the West Hawaii Explorations Academy or Kuokala down in Puna. And then some of them are up at 3,000 feet in Waimea.
Mm-hmm.
So they can grow wheat and grains and things that the folks down on the ocean front wouldn't be able to grow. So part of school gardens is learning what you can grow in your environment and eating what you can grow.
This all gets back to some Native Hawaiian agricultural principles, doesn't it? Ahupua'a and that kind of thing.
It does. Here at my desk, I'm sitting looking at that Ahupua'a poster that Kamehameha Mayor School put out many years ago. And really, that's the kind of vibrant agricultural system that we hope can be developed here in Hawaii over time as our children are reconnected to the land and to the source of good and healthy food.
When you talk about things that grow better, you know, down at sea level versus at 3,000 feet, in the Ahupua'a system, there was an exchange, right?
There was.
Can you get that sort of thing going with school gardens, or do you?
Well, not yet, because school gardens are mostly teaching gardens, so they're not so much dependent on production, but some of them are moving in that direction.
Mm-hmm.
So they have production that will take food into a student-led market, and then they also have production for the children so that they can taste all of these foods and have healthy snacks every day.
It would actually take a few years to get to have something be self-sustaining, no matter how much land you had available, right?
Oh, absolutely. It takes many, many years to develop a sustainable garden system. Yeah, and, you know, there was up through the 1970s, Hawaii schools, almost every school had a school garden. And some of them are quite large. I know right here in Kona, the Halu'aloa Elementary School had a garden that was about half an acre. And the children tended that garden. All the food went into the cafeteria. And the older children were actually part of the cafeteria staff at that time. So then from the 1970s to today, we've kind of gotten away from that kind of form of self-reliance and have been relying more and more on imports.
Yeah.
But there is a new and vibrant grassroots movement across the state, not just here in Hawaii, but we have school garden networks now on every island, and we're all connected through the Hawaii Farm to School and School Garden in Hui. And so this is really something that's rising from the communities all across the state.
Well, Nancy, I'm surprised to find out that it's something that's rising again, that it was strong and then kind of faded away. Any idea why it did sort of fade from being emphasized?
Well, I mean, I moved here to Kona in 1976, and I remember at that time there was very few supermarkets. You know, people were still having backyard gardens because it had been a traditional food sources here to have your own gardens, exchange with your neighbors, hunting, fishing, and whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But then as time went on and the bigger stores came in from the mainland, you know, now at Costco you can pretty much buy anything you want. So I think over time we've become more dependent on foods coming in from the mainland and less dependent on our own local sources.
Kind of moving in exactly the wrong direction then.
Well, I think, you know, there's quite a few people that think so, and I can see at the legislature this year there's also renewed interest in food self-reliance and food security for Hawaii.
I certainly get the feeling, Nancy, that's food self-reliance is a movement that's here to stay, if only going to grow, don't you?
Oh, I think so. I mean, being the most isolated island chain in the world, 2,300 miles from the nearest ports,
mm-hmm.
then the two ports of Los Angeles and San Francisco are actually the two most vulnerable ports in the United States because of the San Andreas Fault. So I would think that, you know...
That's comforting.
I would think that in the era of globalization, you know, we really have to rethink our food system. But what I see is that when you do reconnect the children with the land and their food and hands-on learning in school gardens, you can really build more than a movement. You can actually build social change into your culture. It's going to take time.
Yeah.
But these children will all grow up knowing how to put in home gardens.
It's a very different consciousness, isn't it, Nancy?
Very, very much so.
Thanks very much for talking with us this morning.
Absolutely.
Nancy Redfeather runs the Hawaii Island School Garden Network, which currently supports 63 school and community gardens. And you can find out more about the program at hpr2.org.
Island guitarist Chris Yetton returns to HPR's Atherton Studio February 22nd at 7:30 p.m. A protege of both Keola Beamer and John Keawe, Chris brings his unique blend of slack key and fingerstyle guitar to HPR on Saturday, February 22nd. Call 955-8821 during business hours or purchase online at hprtickets.org.
The whole idea of nutrition in schools, you know, a lot of my school lunch memories had to do with what was government surplus at the time. So the emphasis was very heavy on starches and cheese. The cafeterias would get these colossal blocks of U.S. Department of Agriculture cheese, which they would then spread out in every conceivable thing on the menu.
Oh, I see why you have some of the attitudes you do.
Traumatized youth.
Utterly traumatized. See, my mother made lunch for me. We didn't have a big cafeteria situation like that in the schools I attended, many of them at least. And so she was very finicky about what was going to go in my mouth.
Well, lucky you, because, you know, the whole idea of food consciousness, not just growing it, but, you know, changing your attitude about what is good for you. That's a big change.
But it all starts with what you learn at home. As my
does,
kids
yeah.
may attest, for good or not so. Anyway, that's going to do it for us for today. We hope you've got some goodies in store for the rest of it. On tomorrow's agenda, we're going to talk about 1 billion rising, bringing awareness to the global issue of violence to women.
And the unique sound of a handbell choir.
You can talk back to your radio on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation, and we promise we'll talk back. Or you can tweet us at HI Conversation or me at BecauseHPR, or even email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
And if you want to hear today's show again, get another past show, or links to more information, check the archive on the HPR website, hpr2.org. I'm Chris Vanderbilt.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. I'll see you later for Town Square, and we'll both be back tomorrow morning for more of The Conversation.